This is KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Non-Human Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Ohm Foods, serving organic, non-GMO whole foods, including wild-caught mahi-mahi, and having the largest vegan menu in downtown Chico. Ohm Foods serves homemade teas, lemonade, acai bowls, and smoothies blended with coconut water, and you can find them at 142 Broadway, just two blocks from Chico State. They're open Monday through Saturday from 11 a.m. till 7 p.m., with to-go and catering available. For more info, you can find them at iloveohmfoods.com and, of course, on Facebook. And Non-Human Radio is also made possible by Peterson Tree Care, because trees need care. John Peterson continues his family tradition of caring for Chico's amazing natural resource. Licensed, bonded, and insured with financing available, Peterson Tree Care handles residential and commercial properties and can be reached by calling 518-0924. Up next, Non-Human Radio. And welcome to show 1950, the December 11th, 2019 episode of Non-Human Radio, a roundup of current issues on animal issues, focusing on animal agriculture, animal rights, and veganism. I'm your host, Jeannie Trezino, and I'm here every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico. And you can listen to the show streaming and archived at kzfr.org. On today's show, we'll be covering a few news stories. First up, a new criticism of the planned permanent extension of cattle and dairy leases at Point Reyes National Seashore. New York Times coverage of Veggie Mijas, a collective of non-binary, female-identifying people and women of color doing vegan activism across the United States. The milk war in Sweden, pitting dairies against upstart brand Oatly, and will end with an interesting bit of history. That time back in the 1980s when a whole country stopped subsidizing its farmers. We'll end, as always, with the Chico Vegan Calendar of Events. Our first news piece is an article from the December 4th edition of the Point Reyes Light by Laura Cunningham. Laura Cunningham is the California director for the Western Watersheds Project. She is responding to an issue that we've mentioned on the show several times, the proposed permanent extension of grazing leases to private ranches and dairies on national park lands at the Point Reyes National Seashore. Laura Cunningham writes, in the lead story of the November 13th edition of the Point Reyes Lights, ranchers argue that so-called carbon farming ought to be a key focus of the updated general management plan for the Point Reyes National Seashore. Although the livestock industry hopes to sell the public the false narrative that cows in the seashore can somehow be a part of a climate solution, the reality is that heavy cattle grazing there is decimating the ability of the land to sequester carbon. Those soil carbon losses add to heavy methane emissions that come from more than 6,000 cattle that graze the Point Reyes Peninsula and the northern reaches of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area year-round, including federally defined, quote, concentrated animal feeding operations, that's CAFOs, reliant on trucking in tons of cattle feed from outside the park. The myth of carbon farming on park lands is belied by our own field observations of heavily overstocked beef and dairy cattle on these coastal hills and valleys, so much so that noxious weeds such as milk thistle, poison hemlock, and European annual grasses are pervasive on the cattle pastures. These invasive weeds, spread by cattle and sometimes intentionally planted and harvested for cattle feed such as radish and mustard, not only provide low-quality habitat for native wildlife but also minimize soil carbon. Annual grasses have shallow, sparse roots and die back each year, giving up their carbon as they decompose, not sequestering it for the long term. Native coastal bunch grasses are perennial, living year after year after developing deep, extensive networks of roots that sequester carbon underground. In addition, native woody shrubs like coatibrush, can store even more carbon for even longer. Scientific studies show that shrub grasslands, like the ones that are recovering on Tomales Point after the retirement of the historic Pierce Ranch and the protection of the area as an elk preserve, have the potential to lock up even more carbon than forests and could collectively counteract as much as one-third of our nation's fossil fuel carbon pollution. Even worse, the carbon farming methods touted by ranchers seem to equate to collecting the overabundance of dairy manure from concentrated feeding and milking barns, liquefying it in ponds next to streams that empty into public beaches, and then trucking and spraying this liquefied manure onto cow pastures and silage fields. Heavy winter storms then wash this manure into watersheds, the ocean, and Tomales Bay, resulting in fecal coliform contamination and human health warnings. Dumping manure on degraded, overgrazed agricultural lands to increase carbon sequestration is currently in the experimental stage, but one thing is abundantly obvious. Such heavy-handed methods are mainly suited for heavily manipulated private lands. It is unlikely that such methods will ever be compatible with restoring or maintaining native vegetation, and as such, should not be attempted on public lands. True carbon sequestration would happen if the park removed cattle grazing and manure in favor of lush native perennial bunch grasses with deep roots. Deep-rooted bunch grasses such as Idaho fescue, red fescue, blue wild rye, California oat grass, and tufted hair grass store much more carbon when allowed to flourish free of domestic cattle grazing in symbiosis with soil fungi that create healthy soils. These lands are supposed to be managed to protect and preserve nature for the enjoyment of the people. Congress, in passing the 1962 enabling legislation and the 1978 amendment, required that the National Park Service manage ranch leases in a manner that does not impair natural resources and wildlife at the seashore. We find that the mountains of manure produced by dairies, the erosion of hills and stream banks, the poor quality of ranges, and the lack of true carbon banking here amount to major impairment of this park jewel of the Pacific Coast. That was an article entitled, Point Reyes Livestock Hinders Soil Carbon Banking, from the December 4th edition of the Point Reyes Light by Laura Cunningham, the California Director for the Western Watersheds Project. She is also the author of State of Change, Forgotten Landscapes in California, which is a book about native California ecosystems that are disappearing as a result of agricultural conversion and development. So, you know, there is what we want to believe, carbon sequestration as a result of cattle grazing and dairy farms, and there is the truth. And I think we should proceed with caution, as this author suggests, when we look to justify granting permanent rights to private entities on public lands like this. You're listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio hosted by Jeannie Trezino. If you want to follow more current events and animal rights-related news, I invite you to follow the Non-Human Radio Facebook page. Our second news piece is an article from the October 19th issue of the New York Times by reporter Alexandra Weiss about a veggie-centric advocacy program reaching out to marginalized people. The article starts out, Veggie Mijas is a collective of over 300 non-binary female-identifying people and women of color in 12 chapters across the United States. And the group, originally founded by Amy Kichis and Maria Bermeo, facilitates community building through vegan potlucks, cleaning up community gardens, and hosting youth seminars to teach children about the importance of growing their own food. Ms. Kichis, age 24, a native of Queens, New York, who is Peruvian and Colombian, told the New York Times that, quote, Veggie Mijas is about reclaiming what a plant-based lifestyle looks like, which isn't just about not eating meat. It's about what we can do for our communities and about reflecting on the systems around us that impact the choices that we make. In 2018, following a return to New York City after college, Ms. Kichis started asking for recipes from other Latinx people in her community as part of her many attempts to start eating healthier in the aftermath of late-night binges as a student. Don't we all know that? She started an Instagram account and then a website as a resource for recipes and community. The response she got prompted her to start the collective. Brandy Skorker, age 33, a Veggie Mijas organizer from Boston, told the New York Times that, quote, mainstream vegan spaces, both online and in person, aside from being predominantly white, have been middle class and able-bodied. I have to agree with that. That is an accurate assessment of many online spaces for vegans. Therefore, Veggie Mijas has several foundational pillars to address that. The first pillar, the collective questions everything. They consider every aspect of food production, how it's labeled, and how it's being sold. Ms. Kichese told the New York Times that, quote, just because it says organic doesn't mean it's healthy, noting soy as an example. It's technically good for you, but you're not supposed to eat it all the time, and it's not necessarily ethically grown. The revolution we want doesn't include capitalist brands profiting off people of color. It's about supporting ourselves by learning what's good for us. The second pillar, the collective insists that you know where your food comes from. The easiest way to know about your food is to grow it yourself, which is an unrealistic expectation for many. But you don't need your own farm. Volunteering at a community garden is a great way to gain access to land on which to plant while also engaging with your community. It's very sensible. Farmers markets are another way to be conscious of where your food comes from. In New York, for example, farmers markets accept food stamps. Veggie Mijas, and Mijas is a Spanish term of endearment, offers an online directory on its website that helps you find a farmer's market in your community. And of course, in Chico, we know our famous ones, our popular ones, are the Saturday morning farmer's market and the Wednesday morning farmer's market. And then there's also a farmer's market, a small market collective, Monday evenings at Blackbird Cafe. The third pillar of the Veggie Mijas Collective is the collective encourages members to write down their parents' recipes. Learn about the plant-based foods your parents ate and incorporate them into your diet. When Ms. Kichese started eating a vegan diet, she took home a bag of quinoa from Whole Foods. Her father laughed and said she used to eat the quinoa as a poor child in Peru. Finding out the history of different vegetables and recipes shows you how they have been commodified, Ms. Kichese said. Looking into your own cultural background can also teach you about other ways food can be important. Food is medicine, she said. Our ancestors made healing foods and survived because of it. The fourth pillar of the collective also recommends to not be afraid to change those recipes. Another problem the women have encountered, even within their own communities, is that people believe they can't cook traditional dishes without meat and dairy products. When Ms. Kichese recently spoke at the University of California in Santa Barbara, a student told her she didn't know how to go vegan as a Salvadoran because she would miss her food too much. To help with that, Veggie Mijas has compiled traditional recipes with a modern spin, like vegan ceviche, into an upcoming cookbook titled Casa Verde. And on their website, there are also some a couple of YouTube videos on how to make traditional recipes vegan style. The fifth pillar of Veggie Mijas, organize your tribe. For Ms. Squirker, the Boston organizer, healthy options were generally inaccessible in her home community in Vermont, so her friends would just opt for fast food. When she was 25, she wanted to make a life change and sought out community to help her do so, but wasn't always met with enthusiasm. The reactions to her saying, "I'm vegan," in her hood were something she learned not to take personally. She acknowledged that veganism can be expensive, and in places where vegetables don't grow and folks rely on meat and milk, paying $14 for a bag of grapes is just not an option. The collective spreads the word online and at events, as well as through what Ms. Kichese calls the old-fashioned way, printing up homemade flyers and passing them around. When it comes to creating a new chapter, anyone can contact the group through its website at VeggieMijas.com, and that's Veggie, V-E-G-G-I-E, Mijas is M as in Mary, I-J-A-S.com, VeggieMijas.com. The collective gently reminds people that there are benefits to a vegan diet, even if it is not 100% of the time. Not everyone can manage to be completely plant-based all the time because of finances, health, or other limitations. Ms. Kichese told the New York Times that, quote, a lot of people militarize veganism, and it's important to not do that. You have to figure out what it means for you. And that's all about going vegan is a path. It's progress, not perfection. Every little bit counts, and you have to acknowledge and respect and accommodate where you're at. Whether being vegan means cutting out all animal products or eating them only when you don't have access to vegan alternatives, if you change the way you eat, you'll change the way you think about the world. That can include where you shop, what you wear, how you recycle, and what you buy. Ms. Kichese concluded her interview with the New York Times saying that, quote, when we talk about access, whether it's fast fashion or fast food, even though I'm wanting that $5 shirt because it's affordable, you have to be conscious of why it's so cheap. Thinking about those things are the first step, and that is like such wise information. You cannot even be motivated to make changes, massive changes in your purchasing habits until you understand why you're doing them. And that is one reason why health arguments can be somewhat motivating, and certainly ethical arguments can be very foundational to making any kind of change, whether it's diet or other purchasing actions such as clothing. And that was an article titled Veggie First Eating and Thinking from the October 19th edition of the New York Times, written by Alexandra Weiss on the up-and-coming collective called Veggie Mijas, founded by Amy Kichese and Maria Bermeo. For more information, you can visit their website at veggiemijas.com, and they have two chapters in California, one in L.A. and one in Oakland, and then, 10 others all over, of course, in New York. They're in Texas, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Arizona, and two in Florida. So I'm glad to see this kind of grassroots organization happening for vegan action. Our third news story is an article from the Live Kindly website, posted on December 10th and written by reporter Jemima Weber about the ongoing milk war in Sweden. So I think you'll enjoy this one. The article starts out, Sweden is currently in a milk war, according to the news magazine The Outline. The country has long been a lover of cow's milk, but in recent years, Swedes are leaning away from dairy. Per capita consumption of milk in Sweden has decreased from 34 gallons annually in 2007 to 27 gallons in 2017. And I just looked it up. According to the website Statista.com, U.S. per capita consumption of milk was just 17 gallons in 2017. So the Swedes are really big milk drinkers. Many Swedes are replacing dairy with vegan milk, and the dairy industry is keen to squash that pattern. Earlier this year, Swedish dairy giant Arla launched a handful of anti-vegan milk television ads. One commercial sees a room full of dispirited workers drinking a product called Pjölk, a made-up product that's likely taking a swing at Oatly. At the end of the ad, a carton of Pjölk is punched off the screen as a vocalist sings, milk is milk. It's followed by the slogan, only milk tastes like milk. The big company Oatly, for its part, responded to the Arla commercials by trademarking those made-up words used in that commercial. The vegan company began printing those words, including Pjölk, Bruk, Sulk, and Truk, on its own packaging. Oatly creative director John Schoolcraft told the online magazine Outline that, quote, it must be terrible to wake up one day and realize consumers see through your propaganda and that your products are totally out of sync with what the planet needs to ensure its future. That an oat milk company shows up possessing no fear at all and all too eager to witness your demise must be dreadful. I don't feel sorry for them at all. Quite an attitude there. Arla, the milk conglomerate, isn't the first to take issue with Oatly. The Swedish dairy lobby LRF Mjölk once sued Oatly for vilifying cow's milk, especially irked by the Oatly slogan at the time, milk, but made for humans, which was how they described their oat milk. In that case, the dairy conglomerate won, and Oatly was forced to stop using that tagline and was forced to pay the conglomerate over $100,000. But not satisfied with that outcome, Oatly proceeded to publish the text of the lawsuit. That aggressive stunt led to a 45% increase in Oatly sales in Sweden. People's love for Oatly has not been confined to Sweden. As Oatly's profits grow, the vegan dairy brand has entered multiple other markets around the globe, and its message has not wavered. Last month, Oatly erected a billboard at Waterloo Station in London, encouraging people to ditch animal products, saying, "Go ahead, eat like a vegan." I just love that. It's so proud, so assertive. Last year, Oatly launched a nearly $1 million advertising campaign in the UK, including ads in London that featured the controversial but iconic line that was banned in Sweden. It's like milk, but made for humans. The company has shown no signs of slowing down. It now makes canned coffee drinks, dairy-free ice cream, and vegan custard, too. Oatly sells its products in the U.S., the U.K., Australia, Eastern Europe, and in Asia. And this is where the milk war stands today, with a country divided into oat lovers who believe cow milk is destroying the planet and milk lovers who cannot give up taste and tradition of Swedish dairy. This impasse sheds light on the final hurdles many plant-based meat and dairy substitutes will have to jump before they can supplant larger factory farming competitors. According to plant-based food advocates, every meat and dairy substitute that is gaining mainstream popularity today, such as Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat, has been able to dissuade consumers on four key beliefs, known as the four N's, that animal products are normal, natural, necessary, and nice. The first three have been relatively easy to dispel. Veganism is common, it has been proven to be healthy, and it is better for the planet and for the animals than dependence on livestock farming. Niceness, the belief that animal products are tastier than plant-based substitutes, is a much more difficult nut to crack. Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat are the rare outliers that have nailed their flavors and textures well enough to forge partnerships with the meat industry rather than sparking a war. And that was an article titled "Why Sweden is Terrified of Oat Milk," posted on December 10th at the Live Kindly website, written by Jemima Weber, about the battle between the Swedish dairy lobby and Oatly, a rapidly expanding Swedish-based oatmeal manufacturer. And I'll just say Oatly products are available at many local health food stores and also, surprisingly, at Target, which is a surprisingly vegan-friendly place to shop. And you've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio here on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio. If you want to follow more current events and animal rights-related news, I invite you to follow the Non-Human Radio Facebook page. Our final news story is about agriculture subsidies, something that we mention repeatedly on Non-Human Radio as one of the key reasons that enables Americans to affordably torture, slaughter, and eat so many animals in animal products. Generally speaking, ag subsidies were originally instituted to stabilize markets, help low-income farmers, and aid rural development, beginning when Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933. This act created the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, one of the many New Deal reforms to help get America out of the Depression, the Great Depression. Out of this and other bills grew a system of government-controlled ag commodity pricing and supply control, including programs that pay farmers not to grow crops and insurance programs. Now, many farmers, and especially corporate farmers, are dependent on gaming a complex subsidy and crop insurance system to make a profit. As a result, calls to end subsidies in the U.S. and develop a whole new agriculture economy mostly fall on deaf ears because these large interests have no interest in changing a rather complex system that they have gamed. For instance, subsidized insurance is available for more than 100 crops, but corn, cotton, soybean, and wheat are the main recipients. And, of course, soybeans, that's mostly grown for animal feed. Corn is mostly grown for animal feed. Wheat is consumed by humans. So with that background, I think we can learn a lot from New Zealand, which, surprisingly, in the 1980s, instituted massive agriculture reforms. Our final news piece is an article by Mark Ross and Chris Edwards posted back on July 17th, 2012, ancient history, huh? On HuffPost, about the time when New Zealand eliminated its system of subsidized agriculture. The article starts out, "Every 5 years or so, members of Congress from rural areas in the United States team up to push through a costly extension of farm programs. They are at it again this year," which is referring back to 2012, "The Senate recently," that is in 2012, "passed legislation to keep billions of dollars in subsidies flowing to farm businesses, and the House just passed a similarly bloated bill out of committee. Farm bills are an inside game. Politicians never give the public a good reason why U.S. agriculture needs to be coddled by the government. Members of Congress focus on grabbing more subsidies for home state farmers, and they rarely discuss or debate whether all this federal aid is really needed. It isn't needed. New Zealand's farm reforms of the 1980s dramatically illustrate the point. Faced with a budget crisis, New Zealand's government decided to eliminate nearly all farm subsidies. That was a dramatic reform because New Zealand farmers had enjoyed high levels of aid, and New Zealand's economy is even more dependent on agriculture than is the U.S. economy. Despite initial protests, farm subsidies were repealed in 1984. Almost 30 different production subsidies and export incentives were ended. Did that cause a mass exodus from agriculture and an end to the family farm, as feared? Not at all. It did create a tough transition period for some farmers, but large numbers of them did not walk off their land as had been predicted. Just 1% of the country's farmers could not adjust and were forced out. The vast majority of New Zealand farmers proved to be skilled entrepreneurs. They restructured their operations, explored new markets, and returned to profitability. Today, New Zealand's farming sector is more dynamic than ever, and the nation's farmers are proud to be prospering without government handouts. Prior to 1984 reforms, subsidies stifled farm productivity by distorting market signals and blocking innovation. Many farmers were farming for the sake of the subsidies. For example, nearly 40% of the average New Zealand sheep and beef farmer's gross income came from government aid. When the subsidies were removed, it turned out to be a catalyst for productivity gains. New Zealand farmers cut costs, diversified their land use, sought non-farm income, and developed new products. Farmers became more focused on pursuing activities that made good business sense. Official data supports on-the-ground evidence that New Zealand greatly improved its farming efficiency after the reforms. Measured ag productivity had been stagnant in the years prior to the reforms, but since the reform, productivity has grown substantially faster in agriculture than in the New Zealand economy as a whole. Since the reform, agriculture's contribution to New Zealand's economy has remained steady at about 5% of GDP, that is, a gross domestic product. Adding activities outside the farm gate, such as post-farm processing and distribution, agriculture is estimated to contribute over 15% of GDP. By contrast, agriculture's share of the economy has fallen in many other industrial countries. With the removal of subsidies in New Zealand, ag practices are driven by the demand of consumers, not by efforts to maximize the receipt of subsidies. At the same time, the whole ag supply chain has improved its efficiency and food safety has become paramount. Businesses that deliver inputs to farming have had to reduce their costs because farmers have insisted on greater value for money. More efficient ag production in New Zealand has also spurred better environmental management. Cutting farm subsidies, for example, has reduced the previous overuse of fertilizer. And cutting subsidies has broadened farmed operations to encompass activities such as rural tourism that bring management of the rural environment to the fore. The message to American farmers is that subsidy cuts should be embraced, not feared. After subsidy cuts, U.S. farmers would no doubt prove their entrepreneurial skills by innovating in a myriad of ways, as New Zealand farmers did. And we suspect that, like New Zealand farmers, American farmers would become proud of their new independence and have little interest in going back on the taxpayer gravy train. And that was a 2012 article titled In New Zealand, Farmers Don't Want Subsidies, written by Mark Ross and Chris Edwards, posted in the HuffPost.com in July of 2012. I just thought that was a very interesting example. Like, I just assumed that no set of farmers would ever give up subsidies, and that would be chaos if that happened. I'm sure it was chaotic at the first transition, but it sounds like they did well. In the United States, California produces the most food by value, and most of its crops, almonds, wine, dairy, and walnuts, and pistachios contribute to that. Those aren't subsidized, but rice growers are. And crop insurance is available for orchards, as we know, and the price of dairy in California is affected and controlled by really an opaque quota system. This show has also targeted the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service grazing leases as different forms of subsidies as well, all of which contribute to making meat just underpriced for the environmental cost and certainly the suffering involved for the animals. The 2018 Farm Bill, the Agriculture Improvement Act of 2018, is the most recent reauthorization of the Farm Bill. It was signed into law on December 20th, 2018, so we'll look at the next one coming up probably in 2023. You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1, listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino. All right, and that is it for our show today. Coming up next, we have California Burning.